May it please the Court, my name is Cynthia Devers of the Walk Law Firm. We're an aviation law firm that focuses exclusively on aviation crash litigation. The reason I'm here today is because I've been involved in this case from the very beginning, know the facts in and out, and feel very passionate that this is a case that should be heard by a jury. There are numerous factual issues that the Court decided in the light most favorable to the defendant in this case. The crux of this case is about the summary judgment as applied in Delaware law. The summary judgment standard in this case is juxtaposed with the General Aviation Revitalization Act, which is an 18-year statute of repose in general aviation. It's also known as GARA for short. GARA has two separate start periods for when the repose begins. The first period begins from the time of the first sale to the first purchaser, and the second period is known as a rolling provision, and that starts at the time of replacement of a new part. There's also two exceptions under GARA. The primary focus of our argument today is going to be on the misrepresentation exception. Throughout the brief, Appelli has referred to it as the fraud exception, which is an important distinction to refer to it as knowing the misrepresentation exception, because the standard for that is not fraud, it's knowing. The standard for summary judgment under GARA is no different than a standard for summary judgment under state law. So to apply a heightened standard, such as the trial court did here, for the purpose of fostering manufacturer's interest that was set forth in GARA, it's a non-existent necessity. GARA was passed as a compromise between the manufacturer's interest in cutting off the liability at some point.
Well, before we,
yes, sir.
You know, we have a limited amount of time, or I should say you do.
Yes.
So I think it may be helpful to get into the issues. I'd like to ask you in reverse order, because the second issue, which concerns the exception for new parts,
yes, sir,
or replacement parts, I think has just one, there's just one controversy, whereas the misrepresentation claims are more complex.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understand it, if an original part was overhauled, that does not toll the statute of limitations. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What is required is a new part.
Yes.
If a new part is installed in the aircraft, that does toll the statute, or at least the statute begins running from the time the new part is installed, but the claim is against whoever manufactured that part.
Correct, Your Honor. There's
okay.
Also some case law.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. I understand the issue to be here whether or not the record shows that there was a new part installed. And not only a new part installed, but installed by Hawker Beechcraft. And all that is presented to us in the briefs is a writing that says that that a particular part was either overhauled or replaced. Doesn't say replaced. It's either or, I think. Does that meet the burden of proof?
Well, the cases are split to establish whether we have the burden of proof or defendants have the burden of proof.
So we would have to resolve that issue as a matter of first impression?
The cases are actually split. There is a line of authority saying that defendants would have a burden of proof to establish that the second repose period does not apply.
I mean, in our state, a showing that there was actually a replacement of a part requires proof by a preponderance. And all we have here is a writing by someone who I don't even think was deposed, said, well, it was either replaced or overhauled. So how does that meet the standard, if it does?
Your Honor, that gentleman was Mr. Pinto. He was the primary mechanic who worked on Dan Hart's airplane. He did testify under oath in a deposition that all the parts had been either overhauled or replaced sometime in the 2000s.
So it wasn't a writing. There was deposition testimony. Was there any follow-up in that deposition regarding replacement versus overhaul?
He was not able to determine whether it was replaced or overhauled.
So there may not even be an issue on your second argument if the burden of proof has not been satisfied.
Depending.
And I gather that as a practical matter, you're relying primarily on the misrepresentation issue. Is that correct?
Primarily, yes, Your Honor.
But as to the burden of proof, ordinarily, wouldn't the burden of proof be placed on the party who has the evidence? Would be given the burden of going forward, and in this case, wouldn't it be the owner of the aircraft as opposed to the original manufacturer?
There is a split of authority, Your Honor. I do recognize that there is a good deal of authority. A good weight of authority has the manufacturer, the plaintiff with the burden of proof for the rolling provision.
Okay.
But while the cases may be divided on who has the burden of proof, there's no doubt that the case turns out one way if it was repaired and another if it was replaced. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And for you to prevail, you have to show that it was replaced.
Yes.
Okay. Going back to this misstatement, wasn't there deposition by your expert deposition testimony by your expert witness to the effect that he couldn't identify anything that was not included that should have been included?
Your Honor, that statement does exist in the deposition. However, there are many other statements within the depositions that talk about misrepresentations in other contexts. Those questions dealt with reporting requirements under 14 CFR 21.3, which requires the manufacturer to make a determination whether or not a particular report provided by a maintenance facility is something that has to be reported to the FAA. That's very different from reporting defects, and it's also different from misrepresenting facts during certification and during the flight test as well. And our experts do go through at length about misrepresentations with not reporting known defects with the trend analysis.
How about, I thought the question that I asked you about was in the context of the original certification, when the suggestion was made that the FAA was misled. I thought the question was how, and the answer was I can't point to anything specifically.
Your Honor, the deposition testimony dealing with the original certification dealt with whether or not the flap system was interconnected and whether or not satisfied 14 CFR 23.701 at the time of certification and also 14 CFR 21.143, which has to require the manufacturer to establish that the aircraft is safe for flight in all flight regimes.
Well, even if there was a misrepresentation initially, the FAA required flight testing. And where is the causal connection between the flight testing and the cause of death here?
The flight testing, the cause of death here, is critical to this case. The flight testing, it's not a difference of opinion. The flight testing was created so it could pass the test. It was created so it was loaded as heavy as it could get to make it more controllable. It was tested with the most controllable flap configuration. It was not tested at takeoff conditions, which is slower than usual, which is also a factor into making the aircraft more controllable with split flaps.
But bottom line, your point is it's a lousy test.
Not that it's a lousy test. It's a false test in that they represent it based on the best-case scenario and taking advantage of aerodynamic principles that the aircraft was safe for flight.
Did they disclose to the FAA precisely what they did in this flight test?
There's also a factual dispute about that. They did provide a flight test report to the FAA.
Right. As I understand it, your claim is that they overloaded or at least fully loaded the aircraft, you know, which is not a typical configuration of weight. Secondly, they didn't do a flight test, you know, with one flap up and one flap down for takeoff. It was done in mid-flight.
Yes.
Is there anything else that I missed?
Yes, they also tested the flight. The flight that they did, they tested the most favorable flap so they could take advantage of the left rolling tendencies of an aircraft.
All right.
The aircraft has a tendency to roll left.
Right. So there were three things they did that, you know, gave them the best shot at making an argument that, you know, this was a safe aircraft.
Yes.
Were all of those three elements of the test disclosed to the FAA?
The report was disclosed to the FAA, yes.
I'm sorry?
The report was disclosed to the FAA.
However, in the report, did they disclose those three elements of the flight test?
Those three elements were disclosed, yes, Your Honor.
So what was the misrepresentation?
This is just like the Robinson case or the Hinkle case where they falsify a test to get the favorable result. They made this test as safe as possible under the best circumstances to send pilots out and represented that it was safe for flight.
So what they should have done is say, by the way, all these three elements were designed to make, to weight the outcome of the test so that we would pass. I mean, were they required to self-characterize or adversely characterize their own test?
They're required to satisfy the regulation, which is 14 CFR 701. They're required to demonstrate that it has safe flight characteristics in an asymmetric flap situation. How can you say that there are safe flight characteristics if you test the most favorable asymmetric situation?
So it was a lousy test.
It was a lousy test and false results.
Well, the results were accurate based on faulty premises. Isn't that right, from your perspective?
The results were, I respectfully would have to disagree, Your Honor. The results were that it was safe for flight when it was not. The results of the test reported, the flight test reports, they appear accurate. But as far as saying it's safe, it wasn't a safe condition.
Well, here's my problem.
Yes.
I'm the FAA. I get this report. What is it that I should be told that I haven't been told? How am I being misled?
You're being misled because you're told that it's safe. You're told that they are testing the aircraft to determine whether or not it has safe flight characteristics in normal flight regimes. And it's not.
In the eyes of the law, if I'm the FAA, am I presumed not to be able to figure out from the methodology of the test whether or not the aircraft is safe?
Your Honor, under Varig Airlines case, which is cited in our brief, it is a Supreme Court case, and it outlines the process for certification and airworthiness for an aircraft.
I mean, what I'm saying is the FAA presumed to be sophisticated or unsophisticated as far as, gauging whether or not they've been misled by a report of a flight test?
The FAA certainly has many qualified engineers on there. However, they are not the specialists. They're not the ones in the airplane. They're not the ones who are specialized in Beach. And Beach still has the responsibility to give full disclosure, which they've not done.
What is the role of the FAA in saying, we don't want that test, we want a different test?
The FAA certainly could ask for additional testing, but the law does not require the FAA to figure out that they've been lied to in order to come forward and ask for more testing.
Well, were they lied to, or is your argument they were given incomplete or irrelevant information?
They were lied to.
Okay. When you say they were lied to, does that mean there was a false fact or a false conclusion?
I would say
opinion.
I would say both. I would not say it's an opinion. It's a fact. Beach has testified. The 30B6 witness has testified that the aircraft has a left turning tendency. So if you test the aircraft in a configuration they tested it, it's more controllable than we experience here with Dan Hart. He's also testified that if you load it up to max gross weight, it's going to be more controllable. I mean, these are Beach's own people admitting that this test, the parameters of this test were not adequate to say that this aircraft had safe flight characteristics in all regimes.
Do you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, Your Honor, please.
May it please the court.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, Michael Jones from Wichita on behalf of Beechcraft Corporation, Hawker Beechcraft Corporation. On their behalf, I would like to ask Your Honors to affirm Judge Johnston's ruling below that Beechcraft is entitled to the repose that Congress intended when it passed the General Aviation Revitalization Act of 1994. Through that act, Congress made it national public policy that any aircraft older than 18 years is deemed to be non-defective and that its manufacturer should be protected from the long tail of liability that would otherwise come if they were required to stand in perpetuity. The 18 years is the period that was chosen. This aircraft, you'll note, was 37 years old at the time of the accident. It was built in 1969. It was delivered to its first purchaser in 1970. The accident happened in 2007, some 37 years later. That's more than two times the statutory period. So it's served its purpose. It's proven its worth more than two times over. During those 37 years, it's notable also and clear in the record that the airplane never was back in Beach's possession. It was operated by others. It was maintained by others. It was flown by others. And it was maintained by others. But 37 years later, when an accident happened, who finds itself a defendant in the lawsuit? The manufacturer from 37 years earlier. This is exactly what GARA is for. Now, yes, there are exceptions, and we're here to talk specifically about them. But I think you need to approach those exceptions understanding the application of the summary judgment standard against GARA, not against underlying merits arguments. And some of your questions, I think, on the opening session here point out that a lot of what you're hearing about on the fraud exception piece of this in particular are criticisms of flight tests, ways that should have been done differently, could have been done differently. And I'll speak about that in more detail when I go through the individual elements of that. But the important point for summary judgment is...
Before you get to that, yes, there's a quibble about whether the use of the word fraud here overstates the case a bit. I mean, are we really talking fraud, or are we talking about, deception?
If you want to, the literal language of the statute is knowing misrepresentation, knowing concealment, knowing withholding. A number of the cases that we've cited to Your Honors have used the terminology for the fraud exception, probably because it's fewer syllables. But the terminology is what it is, and the cases have consistently held that the knowing element by itself applies to all three of those things. It's got to be a knowing misrepresentation or a knowing concealment or a knowing withholding of required information. That's a key element as well, because it's got to be required information in the context of either the initial certification of the airplane or the manufacturer's ongoing continuing airworthiness obligations as it interacts with the FAA. Though that's an individual separate element. And there are actually five elements to this exception, all of which are the burden of the plaintiff. And there was some reference a minute ago to some split of authority on that. There's one single rogue case that hints at the idea that the burden may be on the defendant on the new parts exception. That's the Glover case out of Washington, I believe it is. Every other case, and we've cited you at least seven of them, I think, go the other way. So I think we can set the burden issue aside unless you'd like to talk about that. But the burden is on the plaintiffs for each one of the elements of these exceptions. And if even just one of the five on the fraud exception isn't established and there isn't a genuine issue of material fact as it relates to even just one of those, then that exception falls away and GARA's repose must stand. Same is true with the new parts exception. Now, I was going to go with the fraud exception first. You started with questions about the new parts exception, so I'd like to go there instead to get that taken care of. Mr. Pinto testified to nothing more than that sometime in the 90s, he looked at the airplane, it kind of looked like it had some stuff replaced. It was either overhauled or replaced. The requirement of the new parts exception is that there be a replacement and that it be a new part. He said nothing. Not only could he say it was necessarily replaced, overhaul is not good enough. A lot of cases say that. But even if it had been replaced, it has to be new. And there's absolutely no evidence in the record that it was new.
It has to be evidence from which an inference could be drawn?
Absolutely none, no. Because in the aviation industry, and the experts acknowledge this as well, even Mr. Pinto himself acknowledged this, that he typically wouldn't buy parts from an OEM, an original equipment manufacturer like Beechcraft, because they're too expensive. Most of these parts are typically overhauled or replacement or used parts. And Congress,
you mean rebuilt parts?
Absolutely, and many of them are. There's a huge industry of rebuilt parts, and if you look at the legislative history of GARA, there's even an allusion to that in that if a part were placed on airplane A and spent 10 years on that airplane and got moved to airplane B, well, it's got 8 years left on airplane B because it's already spent 10 of its 18 years on airplane A. So that issue is important here. There is no evidence, not even a shred of it, that there was a new part put on this airplane, and it's just as likely that it was only overhauled.
All right, so your argument, if I understand it correctly, is that, number one, the burden of proof is on, in this case, the plaintiff. Secondly, what must be proved is that there was a replacement of a part, an original part, by a new part that was that was manufactured by Hawker Siddeley.
Exactly.
Hawker Beechcraft.
Hawker Siddeley was an old version of the company. Right. You're right. Or predecessor, I guess. But that is key here. And we've cited to your honors the Sheasley case, the Pridgen 1 and 2 cases, the Campbell case. There's a whole series of them that talk about this very issue, that it's got to be the manufacturer of the new part who is sued. It cannot be just the type certificate holder of the overall airframe, because if you were to adopt that line of thinking, you would erase GARA from the books, because whenever there's a new part, they can sue not only the manufacturer who made it, but the airframe maker again. That is not what GARA is intended at all. And if that were adopted, you'd cut a giant hole in what GARA was intended to do. So the who's the manufacturer issue is as critical here as anything. But even before you get to that, you look at the record, and Mr. Pinto doesn't even come close to establishing that a new replacement part, even a 90-degree drive, because remember here, we're talking only about that 90-degree drive that had a little key in it that broke. He doesn't even say that that was replaced. He just sort of talks generally about the actuators and the cable and the motor, nothing about those drives. The record isn't there. So they have not met their burden of proof on the new parts exception.
Right, so you're saying if they have a claim that, say, comes under the fraud exception.
If they have one, it comes under the fraud exception. Right. So let's talk about that. Well, unless you have questions more about the new parts
exception. Well, I'm just trying to narrow where the real issues are. As I understand it, there was an initial disclosure that was made to the FAA by Beech. Essentially, the FAA did not accept that and said, we want flight testing. So my first question is, to the extent, if at all, there is an exception or a fraud exception here, it would center on the flight testing. Is that correct?
I agree completely. The interconnectedness issue is one of two prongs that could have been used to certify the aircraft in the first place. Beech said it's interconnected because it's all one system, flap to motor to flap out there. It's interconnected, and that's true. Even under the regulations as they were at the time, that's true. There's no misrepresentation. There's no knowing misrepresentation. But what takes care of that even more so is the point you just made, Your Honor, and that is the causation element is gone because that predated the flight test that the FAA said, all right, you know, even if it maybe is interconnected, you're going to flight test it anyway. And there was this healthy, frankly, back and forth with the FAA about, you know what, we don't think we should have to do that. At the end of the day, the FAA said, you're going to do it anyway. Then we did it.
Okay, so the issue, the legal issue, is whether there was a deception or a concealment or a failure to disclose, a knowing failure to disclose information regarding the flight test.
Correct.
I gather that's the area that we're talking about here.
Absolutely. And then you come to the flight test that was done in 1970.
Well, wait a minute. Before you get there, the test plan had to be developed by someone, right?
Correct.
And was that developed by your client?
Yes, that was developed at Beech at the FAA's direction.
All right. So can there be a misrepresentation in this sense? This test plan will adequately determine safe flight characteristics under 701. Can that be a misrepresentation? And was there such a misrepresentation?
No, it can't be. The test plan is a handwritten document that I will, if I may, Your Honor, refer to. It is B-165 in our appendix. The first part of that is the test report, the report on what the plan was. The second part of it, the appendix to it, is the test plan itself, the handwritten portion that says, we're planning to do this, here's what we're going to look at, and then you execute it. Both of those things together at the same time were given to the FAA. The only record here is that that happened and that both went to the FAA.
Was there an accompanying representation that this test plan would satisfactorily determine that and demonstrate safety and control and maneuvering with one side of the wing's dual flap extended and the other retracted in an asymmetrical position?
The test plan articulated a way to do that. And then they went out and undertook to do the test, and during the testing they said, you know, we're going to modify that test a little bit and do it a little differently. We're going to put the left flap down instead of the right flap, and we're going to test it that way. There were issues because the limit switches are on the left side, the gauge reads on the right side, so it's much easier to do it with the other way down. Beach represented directly to the FAA that, okay, here's what we talked about doing, here's what we did, and here's why we made a change, and here's why that change doesn't make a difference.
I think the thread that runs through the plaintiff's argument is, and I'm using metaphor here, not legally precise terms, somehow the impression was conveyed to the FAA that this was a real hardball test when in fact it was a softball test.
I would ask the appellant to point to where that is in the record, because it's not there. What was asked to do was testing to satisfy 23.701. Beach initially said they didn't think they needed to. Then Beach undertook to do it. It was left to Beach. The FAA doesn't say, here's how you're supposed to test, here's what you're supposed to do. It says, show compliance with the regulation, that with one flap down, one flap up, this aircraft has safe flying characteristics, which by its very term employs some level of pilot judgment as to how safe it is when you fly it. So Beach was left to decide, how are you going to test it? Here's what we initially plan to do. We get out there in the field, okay, you got to change it a little bit. That happens all the time. All of that was disclosed to the FAA and explained to the FAA. And if you look at the cases we've cited to you over and over and over again, Rickert, Burton, Campbell, say this many different ways and many different times. Disagreements about the nature or the type of testing to be done during certification is not the stuff of the fraud exception. If it were, again, the exception would swallow the rule, because that's all you have to do is start making complaints about how you could have, should have, would have tested. That's not what the fraud exception requires. Requires a knowing misrepresentation of required information that is causally related to this accident. They don't have those things here. They have no causation whatsoever. They have no misrepresentation. They have a test report that explained what was done. And certainly, and Burton's good on this, you got to independently have a knowing misleading of the FAA. I asked every one of their experts over and over and over again, do you have anything that suggests that there was something that about that flight test that needed to be told to the FAA but was not? To a person, they all said, no, I'm sorry, I don't have that. That's what the fraud exception requires.
Now, the other side, as I understand it, is saying the misrepresentation was that the aircraft was safe. What's wrong with that position?
All by itself, just saying it's safe, well, that would really unwrite Guerra out of the books, because you could always say that. Any expert can come up and say, oh, I think it was unsafe. They should have known it was unsafe. Surely they should have warned the FAA that it wasn't safe. That would just evaporate Guerra into the ether, if that were the rule. So if that is their argument, I think it fails on its face. Knowing misrepresentation, required information, causally related to the accident, again, Burton, Cartman, Rickert, all those cases, excellent about how you cannot conflate evidence that relates to liability in the first instance with the knowing misrepresentations that are required of Guerra. And that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing an effort to do that. They can always bring forward an expert that can throw that stuff out there and suggest that that's good enough.
Well, the whenever there's a claim of a false representation, there has to be an underlying fact that's false. And then a representation. What does the record show, if at all, about the underlying fact that at least the plaintiff's claim exists, and that is that this test was a softball test and it was not designed to show that in the real world this aircraft, you know, that this flap system would have performed safely.
There's nothing in the record that suggests that it was a softball test other than a few experts for the plaintiffs who say, I would have done it differently. And again, that's not enough. Burton makes it clear, Rickert makes it clear, that to say you would have done testing differently isn't enough. There's no tangible fact, there's no misrepresentation that I would do it this way because it will save me a failure. There's nothing there. There's no record to that effect.
Let me just pursue this for a minute because I'm not familiar with the record. It's one thing for an expert to say, well, I would have done it differently. It's another for the expert to say, you know, I am aware of the test that was done, and it is my professional opinion, based on my experience in this field, that this was an inadequate test to show safety. Is there testimony of that kind in the record?
I would say no. I would characterize it again as I would have done it differently. They should have done it differently. You're talking again about a standard of meeting safe flight characteristics with one flap up and one flap down. Beach designed a plan to do that, tested it, and reported all that to the FAA. And each one of these experts has also...
So you're saying there's no competent evidence of an underlying fact that this was an unsafe test?
I'm saying there's no evidence whatsoever. The other thing to point out is every one of these experts also acknowledged that it is the FAA's call, and that's the words I use with them. It's the FAA's call to decide whether more or different testing needed to be done. Because they acknowledge that if the plan went with it, and if the report itself, as Your Honor alluded to when you were asking questions, the plan itself, independent of the test, exhibits the weight, the configuration, all these things that were done that they say they would have done differently. That was all in the FAA's hands with which to make the decision to decide to do something differently. And that's exactly how the fraud exception is supposed to work. You're supposed to arm the FAA with facts with which they can do their job. We did that. We gave them everything they needed to do their job. And it's when you don't do that and you hide from them things that makes it impossible for them to do their job that the fraud exception can come up. But we don't have that record here.
Did you ever get the sense, as this was unfolding, that the plaintiff's argument was if you'd reversed the flaps that were up and down, you would have gotten a different result, and that you basically picked or selected the flaps to put up and down to get a good result?
Well, they have been suggesting that, but the report itself, if you read it, tells the FAA, all right, we talked about doing the left, right flap down, left flap up, and then we decided when we did the test to do it the opposite way. And the reason for that, again, was practical and obvious. The limit switches, those the things that the flap hits to stop the motor from running, they're on the left side. And if you're going to do it the other way, you've got to either move those limit switches over here or do something different mechanically with it. So they decided, number one, we don't want to do that, so we're going to do it left down, right up. And we don't believe, this was said to the FAA, Beach doesn't believe that doing it that way makes an appreciable difference.
Well, during the course of operating the plane over the life of the plane, would there ever be an occasion when the pilot would want to have the flaps in the reverse order of the test?
Well, the pilot would never want to have asymmetric flaps under any circumstances. As a matter of fact, Mr. Hart should never have taken off with asymmetric flaps because if he'd done his test, they're supposed to put him down and bring him back up. The right one is the one that broke and stayed down. The gauge reads the right one. He didn't look at the gauge. You'd never want them to be asymmetric. He shouldn't have taken off. So in any event, you don't want either one up or down when the other's not. So either way, it's not a good scenario. Nonetheless, because the FAA asked for it and the regs required it, we showed that even if you had that unfavorable, not good situation, the aircraft is still controllable. And if you look at the report, they even did landings in that configuration with a crosswind that is pushing you in the way that the flap's trying to send you when it's asymmetric. So they did all kinds of things there very openly, very
clearly.
But
it takes heroic pilot measures, doesn't it?
I'm sorry?
In those circumstances, it takes some heroic measures on the part of the pilot in order to be able to land a plane that has asymmetric flaps.
No, I wouldn't call them heroic at all. It's safe flight characteristics. What the report says on its face is if you have the worst-case scenario with these speeds, because the faster you go, the more it pulls, The words were, it takes considerably more pilot technique. It doesn't say anything about heroism or anything like that. That's what the reg is about. Can you fly it or not when it's in this bad situation? The answer is yes. It
takes more elbow grease.
It does take more elbow grease. And there's some values in that report you'll see that it took, you know, in some cases it might be 30 pounds, which with one hand would be 30 pounds of pressure. Two hands, it's 15. Well, you can hold that. And that's well within the regs that say 60 pounds is the limit for what control forces you're supposed to be able to endure. So well within all the regs.
One of the things said in the reply brief on page 11 and 12, referring to the P-94 incident, and it says, not only did HBC represent the cause of this incident without having performed any analysis or inspection, it claimed that the flap system's flap limit switch and flap circuit breaker would deactivate the system, making a flap cutout switch unnecessary. However, this statement represented the design of the aircraft, misrepresented the design of the aircraft because the limit switch is only on the left wing and will only trigger failure from the left side. Thus, like the P-94 incident, the right side flap failure of the Hart aircraft left the pilot unprotected by this purported safety mechanism. Neither the trial court nor HBC's brief addressed this misrepresentation. Would you comment on that, please?
I'm out of time to answer the question.
Yes.
I'm glad Your Honor asked that, because please look at that record and look at that letter. That letter about P-94 that's alluded to there is actually a letter between Beach and its customer about that event. First of all, that was not a 90-degree drive braking. That was a cable that actually sheared over toward the motor. The issue about the asymmetry shutoff switch as a possibility was not even a conversation with the FAA. It was with the customer, because the customer has raised the question of, hey, maybe you'd want to have a switch like this. That letter that's alluded to there, and unfortunately it's very illegible, the best copy of it in the record is a B-300. That letter basically says back to that customer, there's no need for an asymmetry switch because the pilot has already in his hands the switch for the flaps and the circuit breaker. Another switch wouldn't help. That was a communication between the customer and Beach. Beach then shared that letter with the FAA. The point there is it's not required information. It's not a knowing misrepresentation. It's a statement that it doesn't need that kind of a switch. There is no fraud there. There's no misrepresentation, no knowing, no causation, none of those elements. It's all gone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, all these questions that we're discussing today, they're all questions, they're factual questions left for a jury. Whether or not Beach really meant it when it said it was the flap system was interconnected in certification. Whether or not Beach really just thought that it was the right flap down versus left flap was, you know, would be the same, and it wouldn't matter which way that the test was performed. Maybe they believed it. Maybe it was fraud. And the cases of Robinson versus Hartzell Helicopter and Hinkle, which are both cited in the brief, talk about something very similar. Both cases discuss disclosures that are made by manufacturers to the FAA. For example, in Robinson, there were charts from propeller testing that were provided to the FAA, and they were accompanied with the flight test report. I'm sorry, with the test report. And the trial court originally argued that the FAA would be able to make determination itself whether or not it was the manufacturer's misrepresenting the actual flight test. I'm sorry, the actual test report. And the trial court rejected the defendant's argument and said that regardless of whether or not the FAA believed the manufacturer and accepted their results or not, it's still up to the manufacturer to be candid with the FAA. The same situation happened in the Hinkle case, Hinkle versus Cessna Aircraft Company. Both circumstances where the data was given to the FAA, but they were given false information accompanying the data, and trial courts found that it's a jury question whether or not the FAA, the defendant actually was immune from misrepresentation exception or not. It's a question for the jury. With the flight test report, it's not just a difference of opinions and expert opinions, such as in the Campbell case and the other cases cited by the defense. It's science. It's aerodynamics. Beach's own test pilot testified that these differences, the increased weight, the configuration of the flaps, would be more favorable than not, and they're more controllable. Beach testified to that. And our experts also testified to that as well. And certainly the flight test pilot who created the program, who was an aerodynamic engineer, he also knew that. Even in the best case scenario, the flight test reports mentioned that at 30 degrees flap asymmetry, that exceptional pilot technique was required. There was no reference of how to operate in this procedure at all in the airplane flight manual for pilots to even recognize or be able to react to an asymmetric flap situation, even in the best case scenario. Beach admits that more pilot technique is required. Beach's flight test report also misrepresents, which is a question for the jury, whether or not the right flap testing was unnecessary because there's really just no difference. We know from Beach's own flight test pilot that there is a difference. It's the question for a jury. The emergency shutdown switch, which Your Honor brought up on page 11 of our brief, had that been incorporated in Dan Hart's airplane with the right flap down situation, he may have been able to survive the accident. The airplane would have shut, the flap system would have shut down. He may have been able to control and regain control of the airplane. This is a question for a jury. Your Honors, my time is up. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and we will adjourn.